And so to continue our conversation in this room, let's take another question from the audience.
Okay. Yes, I want to bring up a point that is rarely discussed, and I definitely appreciate WWM's efforts in bringing up this issue of black male incarceration. But one of the things that hasn't really been talked about as far as solution, keep talking about the politics and what the community can do, and I see mainly the panelists here have been addressing it, but the real issue that is never being discussed is the discretion of the courts and the district attorney's office. And what I would like to really get understanding, do you believe that, Mr. McCann, that the system is fair? Because you already mentioned your disparaging thoughts about change in the political system. But to me, the real issue is your colleagues and what you had the ability to do as well to have discretion in what you do. Even though the law says this, you can choose not even to address the law. The same way we just had a situation in Milwaukee where three white men have choked and murdered a young black male, and the district attorney office has chose to say that wasn't a crime. Those white males didn't know that the pressure that they were using could injure that young man. And that's the type of discretion that is going on in the courts. People where there's criminal perceive criminal activity, where there's no witnesses in the courtroom, there's nothing but the district attorney and a jury, and the DA is keep pushing issues, and I'm talking to jurors talking about, man, I'm glad I was on, black jurors are saying, man, I'm glad I was on that jury. They was about to convict this person. They had no evidence. They just had testimony of one person that said they stole something from the store, and they was going to send them away. And I had to explain to them. But still, the judge has the discretion. So what are you doing to talk to your colleagues, and what can be done to change the discretion of summary judgments of judges and of your department and other departments that you used to work for, excuse me, where they have the discretion to say, we're not going to put them, we're not going to dismiss this charge, but we're going to give you, if you be good for a year and no police contact, this charge will go away, knowing that the neighborhoods are over-policed and that they're going to get police contact, even though you're given this opportunity to remove this particular infraction.
Well, let's see what he has to say. Let's see how what kind of answer you can get. Thanks very much for your question.
There's no question. There's a lot of discretion in the criminal justice system. It starts with the police officer on the street. I think it's basically fair. It's basically fair that you could disagree with that, and I understand why you might. I think it's an attempt. The people that I know that we're are trying to do the right thing. You've got a steady stream, like in the criminal justice system, the judges are turning over regularly. They're not permanently assigned to criminal courts. That turns over. The police situation, the most discretion, I think, is right on the street. Do you make an arrest or not? Do you go up the alley, investigate what's going on there or not? So there's discretion day one in the with the police officer. Into the district attorney's office, the discretion there to charge or not to charge. When you go into court, it's a decision of the bail, released on bail or not released on bail. When you go into sentencing, sometimes the judge is constrained by legislation, like mandatory, if you're third or fourth drunk driving, you have to sentence a certain person to a certain number of years. But for the most part, most crimes is not, there's discretion in that. There used to be when there was parole, widespread parole, when everybody got parole, there was much more discretion on whether there would be how long you'd be held or not. Something that hasn't been touched upon is the revocation process. And virtually across the board, virtually half the persons that go to prison are revoked, are sent there by the Department of Corrections. They're revoked on probation, they're revoked on parole, so that that's a steady stream. There's discretion there in the Department of Corrections. Do you revoke or not revoke? So the system is loaded with discretion. That's the reality of it. Where I've seen that limited has been not to promote a less approach, is to get more severe, to say, control sentencing so the judges are more severe. What the push has been, certainly in the last 20 years, maybe it's tapered off in the last some years, but get harder and harder in the system. That's what truth in sentencing was about. Stop the parole, stop the discretionary releases, make that guy serve 100% of his time. So even if he's changed, everybody that goes into prison may get worse, may get better, but we all know you got a 20-year sentence, my God, you're going to change during that time. And at parole, you could say, all right, a parole board, all right, let the guy go. He's done, he's made, we believe he should be released, that discretion. That was done away with, so that there would be, so the limitation, the discretion in many ways can be used for good or it can be used for bad. But the whole system is heavy with discretion. There's no question about it.
How do we change that? That's what I ask, because that's what is affecting black males in the prison, is white decisions against black males, or even people of color judges. I've seen black judges do the same behavior, speak on the community radio station about, I understand the community, but when I observe them in the court, they use this broad discretion where people plead for one thing, and I hear them speak with their public pretender or public defender in the beginning, and they don't realize they're going to jail because their public pretender told them, you just have to do this. They agree to the plea deal. And then the judge say, are you aware that by agreeing to this, you release your rights? And then the judge bank them with the whole thing. Yeah. Push a button or something underneath. I don't know how they do it. But all of a sudden, bailiffs come in out of nowhere, and the person is moved out. And you can tell on their face that they didn't know they were going to jail that day.
Can I respond?
Let's see if the gentleman up here can give you some answers to that.
Discretion is the key.
Okay.
The community piece, and he's this wiggling around that issue.
I think that the discretion is also a key, but we're dealing with a broken system. Let's just call it what it is. It's got patchwork. It's got, you're riding on, it's, the system is a car that's riding.
It's broken.
The only justice I got is when a jury of the community said, let that man out of prison. When we plead guilty, this is where it starts. Don't plead guilty. Let the jury decide. Take your chances with a jury better than, okay, well, we need to change the laws where our laws reflect the federal guidelines, where a jury decide, a grand jury.
Let's let somebody else ask a question, would you please? Thank you very much.
Where a, I'm going to send it to discretion where, the judge to give even the jury.
One way is to look at it is where in a federal system, a grand jury decides whether or not someone is charged. So I think we need to go back to that and put the power back in the people's hands and take it out of systems. Because let's face it, the system is not a person, and everybody's just paying their part, and we're talking about human lives. Whether Democrat, independent, Republican, special interest groups, we're talking about human lives, and we should have better accommodations for human lives in destroying them or proponing them or whatever we do, uplifting them. We should have better humility about human lives. And I think, and one way is to allow the people, put the power back in the hands of the people, because the politicians, the legislators, the senators, everybody has their special interests, and it's not always reflecting what we want for our communities. And so if we, let's play the game. We're in a game because they're playing it well, and the resources going to continue this system, why are we steady buying into a suppressive system that's suppressing our communities, especially in the black community? Why are we steady paying homage to a system that's not working? It's not a state of emergency today or 10 years or 20 years. It's been a state of emergency in Milwaukee for over 50 years.
Reverend Briscoe, I think he has some thoughts about that.
The thing about it is, the more money you have, the less time you do. The more able you are to get a competent attorney, the less able time you are going to go to prison. That is a failed system. The recovery system is the one, only one system in our society that we hold that has to be perfect.
Yes.
If one probation violator commits a crime, it sends fear throughout the whole community. Now every infraction sends that person back to prison or a person related to it. We all remember the Willie Horton system during the presidential election. Wasn't even in the Midwest, wasn't even in the West, but one person's crime while out on probation affected the whole system. It's fear. We should not be sentencing people based on fear or based on popularity. We should have some people in politics who have guts to stand on principle rather than to try to protect the interest of fearful people. We got people going back to prison because they visited their child when they shouldn't have and was in contact with their girlfriend. Nothing happened, but it was an infraction, so now you go back to prison. That's stupid. That's idiotic. That's a failed system. We should not be sending people back to prison who haven't committed a crime, and we should not be putting probation inexorably on somebody for 10 years in a community that's over-policed because they're going to run into police contact. That's a failed system.
I dare say there are people in the audience who are probably not old enough to remember the Willie Horton situation, but But it certainly, for a generation, yes. There are many of us who do remember that very well. But let's take another question from the audience.
My name's Sam Graff, and I'm a graduate of MPS, and I go to UW-Milwaukee. And I work on campus. I spend most of my time on campus, even though I've spent the last 20 years in this city. And it's very obvious to anyone who spends a large amount of time on the east side that you can pretend like Milwaukee is just the east side. When new freshmen come onto the campus, they're told what they should do in Milwaukee, where they should spend their time, where they should spend their dollars. A lot of times when I speak to my friends from high school about these issues, they talk about the issues being centered in the inner city, in those three zip codes of the most problem, and they talk about the solutions needing to come there. I was wondering if our panelists had any opinions about what the students at UWM, whose education isn't being as valued as much as the punitive systems are. If you had any advice, any programs that you think are already in play that are having an effect, anything where we can stop living in that bubble and acknowledge all the citizens of Milwaukee that right now we are not.
Well, I have a pleasure of, like, at the Hope Youth Center, a lot of interns from UWM come and they get the shock of their life. But they also love being there after a while. There's only, like, one person I know that said they couldn't deal with it. But most of the students come and be with the children, they love it, and they come back. Some is more strong than others, and some come from places that they never really even seen black people until they came to Milwaukee to come to school. And that's a beautiful thing, and it's an eye-opener. And they walk through the neighborhood, sometimes with us first, and then some refuse to be escorted. They'll take the kids out themselves, and that's one thing that you can ask them to do more of is to volunteer in different organizations and actually see it for themselves. Because once you touch a person and feel it, and then when them kids come, and then you experience when they come and might tell you they've been raped or robbed or beat, then you know the truth that something really happened. So you see it for yourself, and you ain't just hearing it. Because when you get hear it, you could walk away from it so easily. And when you see it and be a part of it, you can't.
The greatest opportunity for change we have comes from two institutions, from the church and from our educational systems. You have the ability to change the perception of the people that you are going to school with. Your school has done one of the most comprehensive studies of black incarceration to this date. Get involved with that. We don't need sympathy and empathy. We need participation. We need for citizens to get involved, because this is all of us. And you are going to be that future that's going to change this, yourself and other young people who are going to see that this is a wrong system and who are going to go to school and study and change it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Brostoff, and first of all, thank you all very much for coming and discussing this important topic with us today and for your expertise on the panel. I grew up also going to MPS and UWM, and a lot of the kids that I went to school with had a very different trajectory than I did based off of one very simple thing, and that is a law that I never understood and I'd like to get some insight into today, and that's the criminalization of marijuana. A recent ACLU study shows that African-American males in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, rather, are more than six times as likely to go be arrested than their white counterparts, even though usage is the same. So when I talk to people about it, they say, well, it's not a violent crime. People aren't committing violent crimes with marijuana. No, the crimes are not violent. The enforcement is where the violence comes in. How about the violence in our communities where people aren't able to get jobs after that? How about the violence after someone goes through a system that's going to make them more violent, that's going to get them, you know, recidivism rates up, that's going to get them into these situations where they're around people they really shouldn't be around and weren't around their whole lives? How about the violence to the psyche and the soul of our community? The violence is not in the crime. The violence is in the incarceration. And if Washington, Seattle, you know, went to the Super Bowl, Colorado, Denver, you know, we have Washington, D.C. going through it. When is it going to happen in Wisconsin? How much longer can we wait? That's my question.
Great question.
Does anybody want to take a stab at the issue of the criminalization of marijuana and how it plays into this cycle?
I want to say something which I think was a positive development. I'm not answering across the board. This is historically. It goes back to the time that Art Jones was chief of police. What was happening was the suburbs were changing their laws and the police practice. They were using ordinances to prosecute marijuana possession. Now, we're not talking about sale, possession, which meant you'd have no criminal record. Milwaukee had no ordinance. And I, with Chief Jones, and it was the disparity in the impact on the person, so that the kid in the suburb walked away without a criminal record, didn't affect the job as much, but his kid in Milwaukee picked up a criminal record for possession. And there was a fight in the Common Council, but the Common Council did adopt an ordinance so that, and Jones supported it, I supported it, so that we wouldn't be charging a crime in Milwaukee for one act and a misdemeanor and a ordinance forfeiture in the suburbs for a different act. That was an improvement. The decriminalization, what I would hope would happen right now is that, I don't know if it's going to happen or not, that the legislature would fund a serious study over the next 6 months so that when the new legislature meets in January, put up some real money to travel out to Colorado and Washington, do interviews, watch what's happening, what's the impact, to come back with an informed assessment of what's happening and what should we or not do, because that's my opinion. Whether that's going to happen or not, I do not know.
But do we have the political will to do that? And is there, and what can people who are listening and watching do to make sure that our people who make
I have not made up my own mind. I'd like to see what happens. What's the impact? The issues have been raised about driving. What's the impact? How will we be able to deal with people driving under the influence of marijuana? How will we be able to investigate pressure? Will there be a widespread problem of that in Denver and in Colorado and Washington? I would hope that would be intensively studied, lay the facts out, and what's happening. I myself have not made up my mind on it. I did definitely make up my mind that I supported an ordinance for possession here, not legalization, but we don't like to use the term decriminalizing it, but once it became an ordinance and was prosecuted an ordinance, it was no longer a crime.
I'd like to answer that this way. What happens when you put someone in jail for possession of marijuana with the criminal who has killed someone? What happens when you put someone who has a joint of marijuana in jail with a rapist and a molester? What happens when you take someone who has just been left a high school dance or something with marijuana on him and put him in jail with a child molester? Those are common sense things that we have to look at, because one of those people do not belong in jail.
I just think, too, that I mirror and reflect on the question and the answers given. For me, maybe I'm by myself on this, but I'm just tired of spending money on surveys, researches. We know it's a problem. My tax dollars are steady going to people talking. I'm not afraid. I'm not scared. I'm ready to stand and take a stand on what's wrong in my community and our community at large. I'm tired of spending money sitting around talking about stuff. I'm tired of paying my taxes for these research programs and ain't nothing changing. We, the people, need to get out and do what we've been doing, because we created the problem. We have to solve the problem. The problem ain't gonna solve itself. And no matter how many times we spend billions of dollars looking at the problem, it ain't going nowhere. So I'm tired of spending money. It's time to action. It's time for action. Everybody has something to do. And if we, like Joanne just asked the question, how do you get Congress, how do you get government to go for it? Well, we are government, we the people. If we the people can't change and make change in our communities and our country at large, then we need to change our government. They're doing it all over the world. If it's not affecting us and providing the care we need for a safe community and able to move around with our liberties, then we need to change it. And that's happening in this country.
But let me ask you this, and I think, obviously, you're right that we have the ultimate way to choose. We can elect different leaders, but the entire state elects these leaders. If you were to go out to one of these communities, I don't know why we're picking on Brookfield, but Brookfield, or if you were to go to someplace outside of the Milwaukee area and explain exactly this, what's the case that you would make to a voter who looks at Milwaukee and says, oh my God, Milwaukee is just rampant with crime, and the answer can't possibly be to lock fewer people up?
First, I think that not to get around your question, I wouldn't go out to another community. I would stay in this community and say they don't have a bar on every, or two bars on every, within a five-block radius in Brookfield. They don't have a liquor store, seven liquor stores in a 10-block area in Brookfield. They don't have those type of things going on, so you don't have that type of mentality. You don't have, they will go somewhere or not go nowhere at all. It wouldn't be a part of environment. So Brookfield, Menominee Falls, any other, those communities, you don't have different foreigners coming in their community being allowed to create, to have businesses and the money going out of that community. In Milwaukee, in this community, all my life, from every foreigner that came, they come here. This is the stop. In the community, they provide the stores on every corner, the gas station. Everyone comes here and profits from this community, including the prison boom. This is a business. And until we look at it as a business and stop, until we look at it as human beings and stop looking at it as a business or a survey or a system, it's going to continue to happen and people are going to continue to suffer and die.
Well, so you won't.
I would like to add to that. I like to beg to differ. We do have to leave out of Milwaukee. On the 20th of January, I spoke to a crowd twice this size in Wausau, Wisconsin, and I did not change my speech at all. I did not change my demeanor at all, and they understood what I was saying. Somehow, we have got to take this message outside of this community to this entire state, because most of them think we are a foreign country here in Milwaukee. They think that what happens in Milwaukee does not happen all over. There were only about 10 black people in that audience, and I did not tailor my speech to those black people. I tailored it to the citizens of Wisconsin. We have got to be bold enough to take this message to Waukesha, where they're conservative, take it to anywhere where they think that Milwaukee is a foreign country and that we don't exist and we're not a part of this state. Because if one of us perish, we all perish.
Sorry, Johnson, briefly, we have two questions left in about 10 minutes.
You know, I was like in agreement, you know, when you asked that question, it's going to be hard because, like, when my man was talking to E. Michael McCann, it ain't broken to the people that fixed it like that. You know what I'm saying? So it's hard that we say it's broken, but the people that we talking to, it ain't broken because they fixed it like that. If I fix up something and you say it's broken, like my hand is broken, you know what I'm saying? So you might notice it, but to me, since I could work it, it ain't broken. You know what I'm saying? So if I go to Brookfield and say it, they ain't seeing it broken. If I go to Wall Pond, it ain't broken. You know, it's like when you go to Wall Pond and them other counties, they get some type of count for each inmate that's in their prison. They count us. We might can vote, but they count us. So if it's 2,000 prisoners, they say they add that to their count. So that we helping them. So yes. Why would they want to fix something that we say is broke? Because it ain't broken to them.
Well, let's take another question. We have two questions remaining. Please.
I have two comments. My name is Lucy Hawking, and I'm a public school teacher in Racine. The reason I'm not in the classroom today is this is our spring break. So I'm really happy to be here. Two things. Many of us in Racine are reading a book called The New Jim Crow. Michelle Alexander, I recommend it to anyone who's listening and to the audience here. As a child of the 50s, I didn't experience the real Jim Crow until my dad worked at Ellis Chalmers, took us to a family vacation in Southern Maryland. And we went to a Catholic church right past a brand new Catholic church that the people we were with said they'd built for their black people. And we went to a ramshackle old church, Catholic church, and I'm sitting there sweating, wondering why people are sitting in the air-conditioned church and why we're sitting with all these white folks. And that was my first real exposure to Jim Crow. And there were some very other discriminatory things that my brother and I experienced as white children, wondering about why these black people are treated this way. Our parents didn't have the talk with us before we went south, and when we were there, we had the talk, and we realized that's why my parents did not retire to Southern Maryland, because they did not believe in treating black people the way it was. Now we have, this book has opened my eyes about a new Jim Crow. And as you're saying, there are plenty of folks who like it the way it is. And if people look historically to the 50s, 40s and 50s, that this new getting tough on crime was the new way of talking about racism and keeping the races separate. So the new Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander. The other point they like to bring up as a teacher, a reading teacher, so of course I've got to suggest a book, is we know the achievement gap, whether it's in Racine or Milwaukee. And I know from some of the research that many of the people that are incarcerated, especially black men, really have struggled in high school. There's a huge dropout rate if they make it to high school. And that reading, math, writing is a real problem. So when we're looking at where we're putting our money, into prisons or into education, especially in the state of Wisconsin, I think this is a really important discussion to have about preschool all the way through K-12, so that more people can be educated and not have the problem we have now. And in prison, I heard you say, there really needs to be a place for GEDs and getting, and which are tougher to get now, by the way, if people don't know, GEDs and high school and college diplomas. So I applaud you and thank you for being here.
Well, we should know, Mark Evans, you actually got your degree while you were in prison.
Yes, I actually took the initiative to seek higher education because I know it's the foundation, it's the catalyst to for a change individual, because without being educated, without learning or being able to articulate what my needs were, I was clueless. So it involves a maturity, and you have to want to. And I think you're absolutely right. It starts at education. Our children are trained, whereas little Elijah Wan in first grade may push a chair and run away from the teacher. It's recorded and documented. But if little Tommy does the same thing, oh, little Tommy, don't do that. It's no history of it 15 years later. I look back as I matured and understood the system and saw that, why would they record this when I was in kindergarten? I didn't understand it. So, yes, it's a racist system. Let's talk about it. If you don't want to talk about it, we can leave the room. Let's talk about it. It's a disparity, and it starts in the education. And education in this country is a great thing. We need it in the world. You need education. But those who it's afforded to, it is the question in this country. So let's just be real. What kind of education are we getting in our communities compared to the education that they're getting abroad?
I know, I saw the sign up. There's 5 minutes or less.
Yeah. Gosh, I'm a state representative, and thank you so much for everything you've said, and it just really rings true. And I just have a few facts and then maybe a question, but we had the recent WEDIC study of where jobs were created across the state, and in Waukesha there were 7,000 jobs created. In my district, none. In Latonya Johnston's district, none. There are not jobs being created in Milwaukee by this effort, so you're absolutely correct on that we have to invest more in jobs. And I know one of the things that we can do is get people out to vote, as people have mentioned over and over again. Yet we are going to be having legislation voted on in the Assembly next week. Well, actually, it's voting in the Senate, and it may come back to the Assembly, that restricts people's right to vote. More and more efforts to restrict people's right to vote. So I just want people to understand how that impacts changing the system, too. And then lastly, I did introduce a bill with Senator Harris on racial impact studies being done for any new legislation or any changes, because when I got to Madison, I realized that there was no law out there that many people did not want to make tougher. And I think Ms. Williams asked, do people know the consequences? And I asked that, too. Do people carry around a little code book with them and say, well, I better not commit this crime because that's going to be a higher level felony than if I do this crime? And they don't. They don't. And it doesn't deter crime. So the racial impact study does not look like it will be going anywhere. But just your thoughts on having something that when we do make laws tougher or introduce new criminal laws on having a study, it would be the same as an environmental study. We do that. We do fiscal impact studies, but we don't do one based on race.
We run from it. We run from it because it supports, that study will expose the disparities. It would expose the system as what it is. We don't need no exposure. We already know why we're not doing anything about it. There's a question.
Again, that's going to have to be the last word on today's Project Milwaukee broadcast. We do invite you to weigh in on the conversation by visiting us at facebook.com/WUWM radio and join us for a town hall meeting Tuesday evening, May 20th.
And you can see the 90 minutes of this broadcast, the WUWM live radio broadcast that we just concluded, and this additional 30 minutes on MPTV. It'll be streaming on mptv.org beginning on Thursday, March 13th. You can watch all of our conversation. And then on Black Nouveau this coming Wednesday, I'll have a conversation with three inmates about their experiences in prison, all part of Project Milwaukee, a combination of WUWM radio and MPTV. Thank you very much for joining us.